Side 6. Death is a Lonely Business. Continuing on page 247.
You wouldn't happen to be the fuzz?
No, just the goofer feathers.
Huh?
Remember the two black crows?
Huh? 1926.
Two white men in blackface talked about goofer feathers.
The fuzz.
From Peaches.
Forget it. Did you write this?
I held out the Janus Green Envy page with the terribly sad advertisement at the bottom. He blinked at it.
Hell no, it's legit. It was sent in.
You ever stop to think what you're doing with an ad like that?
Hey man, like, we don't read, we just print 'em. It's a free country, right? Let me see that.
He grabbed the ad and peered at it, moving his lips.
Oh, sure, that one. Funny, huh?
You realize someone just might look up that geek and believe in him?
Them's the breaks. Hey, look, why don't you fall downstairs out of my life?
He thrust the paper back at me.
I don't leave without the home phone number of this weirdo.
He blinked at me, stunned, then laughed.
That's QT information like no one knows. You want to write him, sure. We pass mail on. Or he comes, picks it up.
This is an emergency. Someone's dead. Someone... I ran out of gas and looked around at the ocean of paper on the floor and, without thinking about it, took out a box of small stick matches.
Looks like a fire hazard here, I said.
What fire hazard? He glanced around at the year's growth of paper wadding, empty beer cans, dropped paper cups, and old hamburger wrappings. A look of immense pride overcame him. His eyes almost danced when he saw the 5 or 6 quart wax milk cartons busy manufacturing penicillin on the window sills, next to some tossed men's jockey shorts that gave the place its real touch of class. I struck a match to get his attention.
Hey,
he said. I blew out the first match to show what a good sport I was, and when he made no further offer of help, lit a second. What if I dropped this on the floor? He gave the floor a second look around. The paper junk seethed and lapped at his ankles. If I had dropped the match, the flames would have reached him in about 5 seconds.
You ain't gonna drop that, he said.
No? I blew it out and lit a third.
You got the goddamnedest sense of humor, don't you?
I dropped the match. He yelled and jumped. I stepped on the flame before it could spread. He took a deep breath and let it blast.
Now you get the hell out of here, you...
Wait. I lit a final match and crouched, guarding the flame close down to a half-ton of wadded rewrites, old calling cards, torn envelopes. I touched the flame here and there and the paper started burning.
What in hell you want?
Just a phone number, that's all. I still won't have an address, so I can't get at the guy, trace him, but I do, damn it to hell, want that phone or the whole place burns. I realized my own voice had gone up about 10 decibels to maniac. Fanny was fighting in my blood. A lot of other dead people were screaming in my breath, wanting out.
Give it here,
I shouted. The flames were spreading.
Shit, man, stomp out the fire, you'll get the goddamn dumb number. Shit, hold on, jump!
I jumped on the fire, dancing around. Smoke rose and the fire was out by the time Mr. Janus, the editor who faced two ways at once, found the number on his Rolodex.
Here, goddammit, here's that crapping number. Vermont 4555. Got that? 4555.
I struck a final match until he shoved the Rolodex card under my nose. Someone who loved you, it read, and the telephone.
Okay,
shrieked the editor. I blew out the match. My shoulders sank with sudden relief. Fanny, I thought, we'll get him now. I must have said it out loud, for the editor, his face purple, sprayed me with his saliva.
What you going to get?
Myself killed, I said, going downstairs.
I hope so,
I heard him yell. I opened the door of the taxi cab.
Meter's ticking like crazy, said Henry in the back seat. Thank God I'm rich.
Be right with you. I beckoned the taxi driver to follow me out to a corner where there was an outdoor phone booth. I hesitated for a long while, afraid to call the number. afraid someone might really answer. What, I wondered, do you say to a murderer during supper time? I dialed the number. Someone who loved you long ago. Who would answer a dumb ad like that? All of us, on the right night. The voice from the past, making you remember a familiar touch, a warm breath in the ear, a seizure of passion like a strike of lightning. Which of us is not vulnerable, I thought, when it comes to that 3 in the morning voice? Or when you wake after midnight to find someone crying, and it's you, and tears on the chin, and you didn't even know that during the night you had had a bad dream. Someone who loved you. Where is she now? Where is he? Still alive somewhere? It can't be. Too much time has gone. The one who loves me can't still be in the world somewhere. And yet, why not, as I was doing, call? I called 3 times and went back to sit with Henry in the back seat of the taxi, listening to the meter tick. Don't worry, he said. That meter don't bother me. There's plenty of horses waiting and lots of lettuce up ahead. Go dial the number again, child. The child went to dial. This time a long way off in another country, it seemed, a self-appointed funeral director picked up the phone. Yes, said a voice. At last I gasped, who's this? For that matter, who's this? Said the guarded voice. What took you so long to get to the phone? I could hear cars going by on the other end. It was a phone booth in an alley, somewhere in the city. Christ, I thought, he does as I do. He's using the nearest pay booth for his office. Well, if you're not going to say anything, said the voice on the other end, wait, I said. I almost know your voice, I thought. Let me hear more. I saw your ad in Janus. Can you help me? The voice on the other end relaxed, pleased by my panic. I can help anyone, anywhere, anytime, he said easily. You one of the lonelies? What? I cried. You one of the lonelies, he had said, and that did it. I was back at Crumley's, back in time. Back on the big train in the cold rain, rounding a curve. The voice on the phone was that voice in the night storm, half a lifetime ago, saying its say about death and lonely, lonely and death. First the memory of a voice, then the session with Crumley knocking my head, and now this real sound on the phone. There was only one missing piece. I still couldn't put a name on the voice. Close, familiar, I almost had it, but... Speak up! I practically shouted. There was an interval of suspicion on the other end. In that moment, I heard the most beautiful sounds of half a lifetime, the wind blowing at the far end of the line. But more than that, surf rolling in, louder and louder, closer and closer, until I almost felt it roll under my feet. Oh, Jesus, I know where you are, I cried. No way, said the phone voice, and broke the connection. But not soon enough. I stared wildly at the empty phone in my hand and squeezed it in my fist. Henry, I yelled. Henry leaned out of the taxi cab, staring at nothing. I fell, getting in the cab. You still with me? If I ain't, said Henry, where am I? Speak to the driver. I spoke. We went. The taxicab rolled to a stop with its windows down. Henry leaned forward, his face like the prow of a dark ship. He sniffed.
He's been here since childhood. That smells the ocean. That other smell, rotten. The pier. This way you live, scribe? The great American novelist? Sure. I hope your novels smell better than this. If I live, maybe. Can we keep the cab waiting, Henry? Henry licked his thumb, peeled off 3 $20 bills, held them over the front seat of the cab. That keep you from being nervous, son? That, the cab driver took the money, will buy you midnight. It'll all be over by then, said Henry. Jeff, you know what you're doing?
Before I could answer, a wave came in under the pier.
Sounds like the New York subway, said Henry. Don't let it run over you.
We left the cab waiting at the foot of the Venice pier. I tried to steer Henry along in the night.
Don't need no steering, said Henry. Just warn me on wires, ropes, or loose bricks is all. But I got a nervous elbow. Don't like touching.
I let him walk proudly on.
Wait here, I said. Step back about 3 feet. There you can't be seen. When I come back, I'll just say one word. Henry. And then you tell me what you smell, okay? And then just turn and go to the cab.
But I can still hear the motor running, sure.
Tell the taxi to take you to the Venice police station. Ask for Elmo Crumley. If he's not there, have them call his home. He's to come here with you fast as possible once we get the whole thing rolling. That is, if it rolls.
Maybe we won't use your nose tonight after all.
But I hope I do. I brought my cane to hit that guy. You let me hit him once?
I hesitated.
Once, I said. You okay, Henry?
Brer Fox, he lie low.
Feeling like Brer Rabbit, I walked away. It was the elephant's graveyard, the pier at night, all dark bones and a lid of fog over it, and the sea rushing in to bury, reveal, and bury again. I picked my way along past the shops and shoebox apartments and shut poker parlors, noting on my way various phones here or there, standing in their unlit caskets, waiting to be taken away tomorrow or next week. I walked out along the plankings, over the sighs and rustles and stirs of moist and dry wood. The whole structure creaked and heaved like a sinking ship as I passed red warning flags and signs which read, Danger, as I stepped over strung chains and found myself as far as I could go, at the edge of the pier, looking back at all the nailed shut doors and rolled down and pinned canvas fronts. I slid into the last phone booth, rummaged my pockets, cursing until I found the nickels Henry had given me. I dropped one in the phone slot and dialed the number given me by the Janus editor. 4555, I whispered, and waited. At this moment, the frayed strap on my Mickey Mouse wristwatch broke. The watch fell to the booth floor. Cursing, I picked it up and shoved it on the shelf under the phone. Then listened. Far off, I could hear the phone ringing at the other end. I let my receiver drop and hang. I stepped out of the booth and stood listening, eyes shut. At first there was only one great roll of surf traveling under my feet, shaking the timbers. It passed. At last, straining, I could hear. Far down at the halfway point on the pier, a phone rang. Coincidence? I thought. Phones ring everywhere all the time. But this phone, 100 yards away, now... Had I dialed its number? Half in, half out of the booth, I grabbed the receiver and planted it back on its hook. Far off in the windy darkness, that other phone stopped ringing, which still proved nothing. I dropped my nickel back in and redialed. A deep breath, and that telephone in its glass coffin, half a light year away, started ringing again. It made me jump and hurt in my chest. I felt my eyes widen and my breath suck in cold. I let the phone ring. I stood out of my booth waiting for someone off there in the night to run from the alleys or out of the damp canvas or from behind the old knock-the-milk-bottles game. Someone like me would have to answer. Someone who, like myself, jumped up at 2 in the morning to run in the rain and talk to the sunlight in Mexico City where life still walked and lived and seemed never to die. Someone. The whole pier stayed dark. No shack windows lit, no canvases whispered. The phone rang. The surf wandered under the boards looking for someone, anyone, to answer. The phone rang. It rang. I wanted to run answer the damn thing myself just to shut it up. Jesus, I thought. Get your nickel back. Get... Then it happened. A crack of light appeared swiftly and went out. Something stirred down there, across from that telephone. The phone rang. The phone rang. And someone stood in the shadows listening to it, tentatively. I saw a whiteness turn, and knew that whoever it was looking along the pier, fearful, careful, searching. I froze. The phone rang. At last the shadow moved. The face turned back, listening. The phone rang. The shadow suddenly ran. I leaped back into my booth and grabbed the receiver just in time. Click. On the far end, I heard breathing. Then at last a man's voice said, "Yes." Oh, my God, I thought. It's the same, the voice I heard an hour ago in Hollywood. Someone who loved you long ago. I must have said it aloud. There was a long pause, a wait, an insucked gasp from the far end of the line. "Yes." It shot me through the ear, then the heart. "I know that voice now," I thought. "Oh, Christ," I said hoarsely. "It's you." That must have shot him through the head. I heard him seize in a great storm of breath and blast it out. "Damn you," he cried. "Damn you to hell." He didn't hang up. He just let the red-hot telephone drop, bang, dance on its hangman's noose. I heard his footsteps rush away. By the time I got out of the booth, the pier was empty in all directions. Where the brief light had been was dark. Only bits of old newspaper blew along the plankings as I forced myself to walk, not run, the 100 long yards to that other phone. I found it dangling and tapping the cold glass of the booth. I picked it up and listened. I could hear my $10 Mickey Mouse watch ticking at the other end, back in that other phone booth 100 miles away. If I was lucky and alive, I'd go save the mouse. I hung up this telephone and turned, staring at all the little buildings, shacks, shop fronts, shut-down games, wondering if I would do something crazy now. I did. I walked about 70 feet to a small shop front and stood in front of it, listening. Someone was in there moving around, perhaps shoving himself into street clothes in the dark. I heard rustles and someone whispering angrily to himself, someone talking under his breath, telling him where to find socks, where shoes, and where the damn tie. Or maybe it was just the tide under the pier, making up lies no one could ever check. The muttering stopped. He must have felt me outside the door. I heard footsteps move. I fell backward clumsily, realizing my hands were empty. I hadn't even thought to bring Henry's cane as weapon. The door opened with savage swiftness. I stared. Crazily, I saw two things at once. Beyond, on a small table in half-light, a stack of yellow and brown and red Clark Bar and Nestle's Crunch and Powerhouse wrappers. And then, the small shadow, the little man himself, staring out at me with stunned eyes, as if wakened from a 40-year sleep. A.L. Schrank in person. Tarot card reader, phrenologist, dime store psychiatrist, day and nighttime psychologist, astrologer, Zen, Freudian, Jungian numerologist, and full-life failure, stood there, buttoning his shirt with mindless fingers, trying to see me with eyes that were either fixed by some drug or shocked numb by my inept bravado. "Damn you to hell," he said, quietly, again. And then added, with some quick sort of impromptu quiver of a smile, "Come in." "No," I whispered. Then I said it louder. "No. You come out." The wind was blowing the wrong way, or perhaps the right way this time. My God, I thought, cringing back, then holding my ground. All those other days, how did the wind blow? How could I not have noticed? Because I thought, oh, damn simple fact, I had had a head cold for a solid 10 days. No nose at all. No nose. Oh, Henry, I thought, you and your always lifted, always curious beak connected to all that bright awareness within. Oh, smart Henry, crossing an unseen street at 9 of an evening and sniffing the unwashed shirt and the unlaundered underclothes, as death marched by the other way. I looked at Shrank and felt my nostrils wince. Sweat, the first smell of defeat. Urine, the next smell of hatred. Then what mixtures? Onion sandwiches, unbrushed teeth, the scent of self-destruction.
It came like a storm cloud, full flood from the man.
I might have been standing on an empty shore with a 90-foot tidal wave poised to crush me for the sick fear I suddenly knew. My mouth baked dry, even as sweat broke on my body. "Come in," said A.L. Shrank again, uncertainly. There was a moment when I thought he might suck backward like a crayfish. But then he saw my glance at the phone booth directly across from his shop, and my second glance down the pier to the phone at the far end, where my Mickey Mouse watch ticked. And he knew. Before he could speak again, I called into the shadows. "Henry?" Dark stirred in dark. I felt Henry's shoes scrape as his voice called back, warm and easy. "Yes?" Shrank's eyes jerked from me to where Henry's voice stirred the shadows. At last, I was able to say, "Armpits?" Henry took a deep breath and let it out. "Armpits," he said. I nodded. "You know what to do." "I hear the meter running," said Henry. From the corners of my eyes, I saw him walking away, then stop and throw his hand up. Shrank flinched, so did I. Henry's cane sailed through the air to land with a sharp clatter on the planks. "You might need that," said Henry. Shrank and I stood staring at the weapon on the pier. The sound of the taxi driving off jerked me forward. I grabbed the cane and held it to my chest, as if it might really work against knives or guns. Shrank looked at the vanishing lights of the taxi far off. "What in hell was that all about?" he said. Behind him, Schopenhauer and Nietzsche and Spengler and Kafka all leaned on their mad elbows, sank in their dusts, and whispered, "Yes, what was that all about?" "Wait till I get my shoes." He vanished. "Don't get anything else," I cried. That made him laugh, a choking laugh. "What would I get?" he called, unseen, rummaging around. In the door, he showed me a shoe in each hand. "No guns. No knives." He shoved them on, but didn't lace them. I couldn't believe what happened next. The clouds over Venice decided to pull back, revealing a full moon. Both of us looked up at it, trying to decide if it was bad or good, and for which of us. Shrank's gaze wandered to the shoreline and along the pier. "He wept like anything to see such quantities of sand," he said. Then, hearing himself, he snorted softly. "Come, oysters," said the carpenter, and took them close in hand. "A pleasant walk, a pleasant talk, along the golden strand." He began to walk. I stayed. "Aren't you going to lock your door?" Shrank gave the merest nodding glance over his shoulder at the books clustered like vultures, with their black feathers and dusty golden stares, waiting on shelves for the touch that gave life. In invisible choirs, they sang forth wild tunes I should have heard long days ago. My eye ran and re-ran the stacks. My God, why hadn't I truly seen? That dreadful escarpment inhabited by dunes, that lineup of failures, that literary apocalypse of wars, squalors, diseases, pestilences, depressions, that downfall of nightmares, that pit of deliriums and mazes from which mad mice and insane rats never found light or made exit, that police lineup of degenerates and epileptics dancing the rims of shelved library cliffs with teams replacing teams of nausea and revulsion waiting in the higher darkness. Single authors, single books, fine. A Poe here or a Sade there is a spice. But this was no library. It was an abattoir, a dungeon, a tower where 10 dozen men in iron masks were penned, silently raving, forever. Why hadn't I seriously seen and known? because Rumpelstiltskin was in charge. Staring at Shrank even now, I thought, at any moment he'll grab his foot and rip himself straight up in half and fall in two pieces. He was hilarious, which made him all the more terrible. "Those books," said Shrank at last, breaking the spell, not looking at them, staring up at the moon. "They don't care for me. Why should I care for them?" "But, besides," said Shrank, "would anyone really want to steal Decline of the West?" "I thought you loved your collection."
"Loved?"
He blinked once.
"My God, don't you see? I hate everything. Name it. There's nothing in the world I like."
He strode off in the direction Henry had taken with his taxicab. "Now," he said.
"Coming or not?"
"Coming," I said.
"Is that a weapon?"
We walked slowly, feeling each other out. I was amazed to find Henry's cane in my hands. "No, an antenna, I think," I said.
"Of a very large insect?"
"A very blind one."
"Can he find his way without it? And where's he going this time of night?"
"Running errands. Back immediately," I lied. Shrank was a lie detector. He almost writhed with delight at my voice. He quickened his pace, then stopped to examine me.
"I take it he steers by his nose. I heard what you asked, and what he answered back."
"Armpits," I said. Shrank shriveled inside his old clothes. His eyes darted first to his left, then to his right underarm, and down along a vast history of stains and time's discolorings.
"Armpits," I said again.
It was a bullet in the heart. Shrank staggered, then firmed himself.
"Why and where are we walking?" he gasped.
I could sense the rabbit palpitation under his greasy tie.
"I thought you were leading the way.
I only know one thing." I moved, this time half a step ahead of him. Blind Henry was searching for some unwashed shirts, dirty underclothes, bad breath. He found and named them for me. I did not repeat the dread epithet, but Shrank, with each word, was diminished.
"Why would a blind man want me?"
said Shrank at last. I didn't want to give it all away at once. I had to test and try. "Because of Janus, the Green Envy Weekly," I said. "I've seen copies in your place through your window." That was pure lie, but it struck midriff.
"Yes, yes," said Shrank. "But a blind man, and you..."
"Because." I took a deep breath and let it out. "You're Mr. Fix-It." Shrank shut his eyes, spun his thoughts, chose a reaction, laughed.
"Fix-It? Fix-It? Ridiculous! Why would you think..."
"Because." I walked on, making him dog-trot to follow. I talked to the mist which gathered ahead. Henry smelled someone crossing the street many nights ago. The same smell was in his tenement hall, and here now tonight. And the smell is you. The rabbit palpitation shook the little man again, but he knew he was still clear. Nothing was proven.
"Why," he gasped, "would I prowl some downtown lousy tenement I wouldn't dream to live in? Why?"
"Because," I said, "you were looking for lonelies, and damn fool stupid dumb me, blinder than Henry, helped you find them. Fanny was right. Constance was right. I was the death goat after all. Christ, I was Typhoid Mary. I carried the disease. You. Everywhere. Or at least you followed. To find lonelies." A drumbeat of breath. Lonelies. Almost as I said it, both Shrank and I were seized with what were almost paroxysms. I had spoken a truth that was like a furnace lid thrown back so the heat scorched out to sear my face, my tongue, my heart, my soul. And Shrank, I was describing his unguessed life, his need, all yet to be revealed and admitted, But I knew I had at last yanked the asbestos up, and the fire was in the open.
What was that word?
Asked Trank, some 10 yards off and motionless as a statue. Lonelies. You said the word. You described them last month. Lonelies. And it was true. A funeral march of souls went by in a breath, on soundless feet, in drifts of fog. Fanny and Sam and Jimmy and Cal and all the rest. I had never put a proper label on them. I had never seen the carryover that tied them all and made them one.
You're raving, said Shrank. Guessing, making up, lying. None of this has to do with me.
But he was looking down at the way his coat was run up on his skinny wrists and the weather marks of late night sweats down his coat. His suit seemed to be diminishing even as I watched. He writhed in his own pale skin underneath. I decided to attack. Christ, you're rotting even as you stand there. You're an affront. You hate everything, all, anything in the world. You told me that just now. So you attack it with your dirt, your breath. Your underwear is your true flag, so you run it up a pole to ruin the wind. A.L. Shrank, proprietor of the apocalypse. He was smiling. He was overjoyed. I had complimented him with insults. I was paying attention. His ego roused. Without knowing it, I had made and baited a trap. What now, I thought? What? What, for God's sake, do I say now? Now? How draw him out? How finish him? But he was walking ahead again now, all inflated with insults, all magnificent with the medals of ruin and despair I had pinned to his greasy tie. We walked. We walked. We walked. My God, I thought, how long do we walk? How long do we talk? How long does this go on? This is a movie, I thought, one of those unbelievable scenes that continue and continue. When people explain, and others talk back, and people say again, it can't be. It is. He's not sure what I know, and I'm not sure that I know either, and both of us wonder if the other is armed.
And both of us are cowards, said Shrank.
And both are afraid to test the other. The carpenter went on. The oyster followed. We walked. And it was not a scene from a good or bad film where people talked too much. It was a scene growing late at night, and the moon vanishing to reappear as the fog thickened, and I was having a dialogue with Hamlet's father's idiot psychiatrist's friend's ghost. Shrank, I thought. What a name. Shrink from this, shrink from that. You wind up shrunk. How had it started? Out of college, on top of the world, hang a shingle. Then the great earthquake of some year, did he recall? The year his legs and mind broke, and there was the long slide without a toboggan, just on his skinny backside, and no women between him and the downfall pit to ease the concussion, lubricate the nightmare, stop his crying at midnight, and hatred at dawn. And one morning, he got out of bed and found himself, where? Venice, California. And the last gondola long since departed, and the lights going out, and the canals filling with oil and old circus wagons, with only the tide roaring behind the bars. I have a little list, I said.
What?
Said Shrank. The Mikado, I told him. One song explains you. Your object all sublime you will achieve in time, to make the punishment fit the crime. The Lonelies, all of them. You put them on your list, in the words of the song. They never will be missed. Their crime was giving up, or never having tried. It was mediocrity, or failure, or lostness. And their punishment, my God, was you. He was puffed now with a peacock stride.
Well, he said, walking ahead. Well?
I loaded my tongue and took aim and fired around. I imagine, I said, that somewhere nearby is the decapitated head of Scott Joplin. He could not help the impulse that moved his right hand to his greasy coat pocket. He pretended to pat it in place, found himself staring with pleasure at that hand, glanced away, and went on walking.
One shot, one hit. I glowed. Detective Lieutenant Crumley, I thought, wish you were here. I fired a second round.
Canaries for sale,
I said in a tiny voice like the faded lead pencil lettering on the cardboard in the old lady's window.
Hirohito ascends throne. Addis Ababa. Mussolini.
His left hand twitched with secret pride toward his left coat pocket. Christ, I thought. He's carrying her old bottom-of-the-birdcage headlines with him.
Bullseye.
He strode. I followed. Target 3. Aim 3. Fire 3. Lion Cage. Old man. Ticket office. His chin dropped toward his breast pocket. There, by God, would be found punch-out ticket confetti from a train never taken. Shrank plowed on through the mist, absolutely oblivious of the fact that I was butterfly netting his crimes. He was a happy child in the fields of the Antichrist. His tiny shoes flinted on the planks. He beamed. What next? My mind swarmed. Ah, yes. I saw Jimmy in the tenement hall with his new choppers all grin. Jimmy in the bathtub, turned over and 6 fathoms deep. False teeth, I said. Uppers, lowers. Thank God Shrank did not pat his pockets again. I might have shouted a terrible laugh of dread to think he carried a dead grin about. His glance over his shoulder told me it was back. In a glass of water? In his hut. Target 5. Aim. Fire. Dancing chihuahuas. Preening parakeets. Shrank's shoes did a dog dance on the pier. His eyes jumped to his left shoulder. There were bird claw marks and droppings there. One of Pietro Massinello's birds was back there in the hut. Target 6. Moroccan fort by an Arabian sea. Shrank's little lizard tongue made a tiny whiplash along his thirsty lips. One bottle of Radigan's champagne shelved behind us, leaning on De Quincey in his dope, Hardy in his gloom. A wind rose. I shuddered. For suddenly I sensed that 10 dozen candy wrappers, all mine, were blowing along after Shrank and me, ghost rodent hungers from other days rustling along the night pier. And at last I had to say, and could not say, but finally made myself say, the terrible final sad words that broke my tongue even as something burst in my chest. Midnight tenement. Full icebox. Tosca. Like a black discus hurled across the town, the first side of Tosca struck, rolled, and slid under A.L. Shrank's midnight door. The list had been long. I was poised on the near rim of hysteria, panic, terror, delight at my own perception, my own revulsion, my own sadness. I might dance, strike, or shriek at any moment. But Shrank spoke first, eyes dreaming, the whispered arias of Puccini turning and turning in his head.
The fat woman's at peace now. She needed peace. I gave it to her.
I hardly remember what happened next. Somebody yelled.
Me.
Someone else yelled. Him. My arm thrust up, Henry's cane in it. Murder, I thought. Kill. Shrank fell back only in time as the cane chopped down. Instead of him, it struck the pier and was shocked from my grip. It fell, rattled, and was kicked by Shrank, so it sailed over the edge of the pier and down into the sand. Now I could only lunge at the little man with empty fists and lurch to a halt as he stepped aside because a final thing had broken in me. I gagged. I wept. Days ago, the crying in the shower was only a start. Now the full flood came. My bones began to crumble. I stood weeping, and Shrank, astounded, almost reached out to touch me and murmur,
"There, there." "It's all right," he said at last. "She's at peace. You should thank me for that."
The moon went behind a great bank of fog and gave me time to recover. I was all slow motion now. My tongue dragged, and I could hardly see. "What do you mean is," I said at last underwater, "they're all gone, and I should thank you for all of them, yes?" It must have been a terrible relief for him, having waited all these months or years to tell someone, no matter who, no matter where, no matter how. The moon came out again. His lips trembled with the renewed light and the need for release.
Yes, I helped them all.
My God, I gasped. Helped? Helped? I had to sit down. He helped me to do that and stood over me, astonished at my weakness, in charge of me and the night's future. The man who could bless people with murder, keep them from suffering, put off their loneliness, sleep them from their private dooms, save them from life, benefit them with sunsets.
But you helped too, he said reasonably. You're a writer, curious. All I had to do was follow, collecting your candy wrappers as you went. Do you know how easy it is to follow people? They never look back. Never. You never did. Oh, dear, you never knew. You were my good dog of death for more times than you guess. Over a year. You showed me the people you were collecting for your books. All the gravel on the path, chaff in the wind, empty shells on the shore, dice with no spots, cards with no pips, no past, no present. So I gave them no future. I looked up at him.
My strength was coming back. The sadness was just about over for now. My anger built a slow pressure. You admit it all, do you?
Why not? It's all sour breath on the wind. If, when we finish here, and I actually walk you to the police station, which I will, you have no proof of what I've said. It's all lost hot air.
Not quite, I said. You couldn't resist taking one thing from each victim. Your god-awful place is full of phonograph records, champagne, and old newspapers.
Son of a bitch, said Shrank and stopped.
He barked a laugh and then made a grin.
Pretty smart. Got it out of me, eh?
He rocked on his heels, thinking about it.
Now, he said, I'll just have to kill you.
I jumped up. I was a foot taller and not brave, but he jumped back. No, I said, you can't do that.
Why not?
Because, I said, you can't lay hands on me. You didn't lay hands on them. It was all hands off. I see it now. Your logic was to get people to do things to themselves, or destroy them indirectly, right?
Right.
His pride was involved again. He forgot me standing there and looked off at his bright and glorious past. Train ticket off his old man. All you did was get him drunk, knock his head on the edge of the canal, maybe, then jump in and make sure he got in the lion cage.
Right.
Canaries for sale, old lady. All you did was stand over her bed and make faces.
Right.
Sam. Gave him enough hard liquor to put him in the hospital.
Right.
Jimmy. Made sure he had three times too much booze. You didn't even have to turn him over in the bathtub. Rolled over himself. Gone.
Right.
Pietro Massinello. You wrote the city government to come get him and his 10 dozen dogs, cats, and birds. If he isn't dead now, soon will be?
Right.
Cal the barber, of course.
I stole Scott Joplin's head, said Shrank.
So Cal, scared, left town. John Wilkes Hopwood, him and his immense ego, wrote him using Constance Radigan's stationery, got him to come naked on the beach every night, scaring Constance out to drown herself?
Indeed.
Then got rid of Hopwood by letting him know you had seen him on the beach the night Constance vanished. You added a really terrible, dirty letter, calling him everything vile.
Everything he was.
And Fanny Floriana left your ad by her door. And when she called and you made an appointment, all you did was come over, burst in, same as with the old canary lady, frightened Fanny so she ran backward, yes, fell, and couldn't get up. And all you had to do was stand over her to make sure she didn't, yes? He knew better than to say yes to this, to say anything, for I was furious now, still shaky, but getting strength from my own madness. You made only one mistake all along the way over the weeks. sending the papers to Fanny, leaving them marked. When you remembered this and went back and broke in, you couldn't find them. The one place you didn't think to look was the icebox. Your newspaper notice put under the jars to catch drips. I found it there. That's why I'm here. And not about to be the next on your list. Or do you have other plans?
Yes.
No. And do you know why not? For two reasons. One, I'm not a lonely. I'm not a failure. I'm not lost. I'm going to make it. I'm going to be happy. I'm going to marry and have a good wife and children. I'm going to write damn fine books and be loved. That doesn't fit your pattern. You can't kill me, you damn stupid jerk, because I'm okay. You see? I'm going to live forever. Secondly, you can't lay a finger on me. No one else has been touched by you. If you touch me, it spoils your record. You got all your other deaths by fear or intimidation. But now if you try to prevent my going to the police, you'll have to commit real murder, you sick bastard. I plowed off with him running after in utter confusion, almost tugging at my elbows for attention.
Right, right. I almost killed you a year ago. But then you made those sales to magazines. And then you met that woman. And I decided to just follow you and collect people. Yes, that was it. And it really began that night on the Venice train, in the storm, and me drunk. You were so close to me that night on the train. I could have reached out and touched. And the rain came down. And if you had just turned, but you didn't, you would have seen me and known me, but you didn't. And
we were off the pier and in the dark street by the canal now and moving swiftly over the bridge. The boulevard was empty. I saw no cars, no lights. I rushed. In the middle of the bridge over the canal, by the lion cages, Shrank stopped and caught hold of the railing.
Why don't you understand me? Help me,
he wailed.
I wanted to kill you. I did. But it would have been like killing Hope. And there has to be some of that in the world, doesn't there? Even for people like me.
I stared at him. Not after tonight.
Why?
He gasped.
Why?
Looking at the cold, oily water. Because you're utterly and completely insane, I said.
I'll kill you now.
No, I said, with immense sadness. There's only one person left to kill. One last lonely. The empty one. You.
Me!
Shrieked the little man. You.
Me!
He screamed.
Damn! Damn! Damn you!
He spun. He grabbed the rails. He leaped. His body went down in darkness. He sank in waters as oiled and scummy as his coat, as terrible and dark as his soul, to be covered and lost.
Shrank!
I yelled. He did not rise.
Come back!
I wanted to yell. But then suddenly I was afraid he would.
Shrank! I whispered. Shrank!
I bent over the bridge rail, staring at the green scum and the gaseous tide.
I know you're there.
It just couldn't be over. It was too simple. He was somewhere out of the light, brooding like a dark toad under the bridge, maybe, eyes up, waiting, face green, sucking air, very quietly. I listened. Not a drip, not a ripple, not a sigh.
Shrank,
I whispered. Shrank, echoed the timbers under the bridge. Off along the shore, the great oil beasts lifted their heads up at my summons, sank them down again, in time to a long, sighing roll of water on the coast.
Don't wait,
I thought I heard Shrank murmuring.
It's nice down here, quiet at last. I think I'll stay. Liar, I thought. You will come up when I least expect it.
The bridge creaked.
I whirled.
Nothing. Nothing but fog sifting across the empty boulevard.
Run, I thought. Run, telephone. Call Crumley. Why isn't he here? Run!
But no. If I did, Shrank might go free. Far away, 2 miles off, the big red trolley bucketed along, whistling, wailing, sounding like the terrible beast in my dream come to take my time, my life, my future away, heading for a tar pit at the end of the line. I found a small pebble and dropped it in.
Shrank.
It hit and sank. Silence. He's escaped me. I wanted to pay him back for Fanny. Then, Peg, I thought. Call her. But no, she would have to wait too. My heart pounded so loudly that I feared the waters would stir below, and the dead rise. I feared that my very breathing would knock down the oil derricks. I held onto my heart, and breath, and made them slow, eyes shut. Shrank, I thought. Come out. Fanny's here, waiting. The canary lady's here, waiting. The old man from the ticket office is beside me. Pietro's here and wants his pets. Come out. I'm here along with the rest. Waiting. Shrank. This time he must have heard. He came to get me. He shot out of the black water like a cannonball off a springboard. Christ, I thought. Fool, why did you call to him? He was 10 feet tall. A dragon yeasted up from a dwarf, Grendel, who was once a jockey. He snatched up like a fury, talons out. He hit me like a balloon full of scalding water, with thrash and yell and shriek. He had long since forgotten his good intentions, his plans, his myth, his murderous integrity. Shrank! I yelled. There was something slow motion and terrible about it, as if frame by frame, I might stop him along the way and examine his astonishing arc and growth and how his eyes blazed and his mouth ached with hate and hands gripped with rage as he seized my coat, my shirt, my neck in iron grapples. His mouth was blooded with my name as he heaved back. The tar waters waited. Christ, not there, I thought. The lion cages waited with doors flung wide. No! The slow motion stopped. The swift fall followed. Fused by his rage, we fell down, sucking air in flight. We struck like two concrete statues and sank, loving each other with a mindless frenzy of passion, climbing each other to keep each other down, making ladders to air and light. On the way down, I thought I heard him whining, wailing, "Get in there! Get in there! Get in!" like a boy at some rude game without rules, and I was playing wrong. Get in! But now, under, we went from sight. We whirled around like two crocodiles at each other's necks. From up top, we must have seemed like a moil and welter of piranhas self-feasting, or a great propeller off-center and amuck in rainbow oils and tars. And at center of the drowning, there was a small pinpoint flash of hope which burst but to fire again behind my eyes. This is his first real murder, I must have thought. Or was there time? But I am flesh and will not behave. I fear dark more than he fears life. He must know that. I must win. Not proven. We rolled and struck something that knocked most of the air from my lungs. The lion cage. He was shoving and kicking me through the open door. I thrashed. We whirled. And in the surge and white water, I suddenly thought, God, I'm inside. The cage. The whole thing ends as it began. Crumley comes to find me, beckoning behind the bars at dawn. Christ, my lungs ballooned with fire. I tried to whirl and knock free. I wanted to shout him off with my last breath. I wanted to... It was over. Shrank relaxed his grip. What? I thought. What? What? He almost let go. I seized him to push, but it was like grabbing a dummy that had suddenly lost its ability to gesticulate. It was like handling a corpse that had leaped out of the grave and now wanted back. He's quit, I thought. He knows. He must be the last one. He knows he can't kill me. It doesn't fit. He had indeed made up his mind. And as I held him, I could see his face, the merest pale ghost, and the shrug that said, I was to at last go free and move up toward night and air and life. In the dark water, I saw his eyes accept his own dread as he opened his mouth, flexed his nostrils, and let out a terrible, gaseous illumination. Whereupon he took a deep breath of black water and sank away, a lost man. seeking his final loss. He was a cold marionette I left behind in the cage as blindly I thrashed for the door, pushed out and pushed up, wildly praying to live forever, to seek the fog, to find Peg wherever she was in all the dread-damned world. I broke up and out into a mist that had begun to rain. As my head burst out, I gave a great cry of relief and sorrow. All the souls of all the people lost and not wanting to be lost in the last month wailed out of me. I gagged, threw up, almost sank again, but made it to the bank and dragged myself out to sit and wait on the rim of the canal. Somewhere in the world, I heard a car pull up, a door slam, running feet. Out of the rain, one long arm reached and a big hand clutched to shake my shoulder. Crumley's face, like a frog's under glass, came to view in a movie close-up. He looked like a father in shock, bending to his drowned son. "You okay? You all right? You okay?" I nodded, gasping. Henry came up behind, sniffing the rain, alert for dread smells, and finding none. "He okay?" said Henry. "Alive," I said, and truly meant it. "Oh, God, alive. Where's Armpits? I got to give him one for Fanny." "I already did, Henry," I said. I nodded down at the lion cage, where a new ghost drifted like pale gelatin behind the bars. "Crumley," I said, "he's got a whole shack full of stuff, evidence. I'll check it." "Where the hell have you guys been?" I wondered. "Damn fool taxi driver's blinder than me." Henry felt his way to the canal rim and sat down on one side of me. Crumley sat on the other, all of us letting our feet dangle over almost into the dark water. "Couldn't even find the police station. Where's he at? I'll give him a hit, too." I snorted a laugh. Water flew out of my nostrils. Crumley leaned close to look me over. "You hurt?" Nowhere anyone could ever see, I thought. 10 years from now, some night, it'll all surface. I hope Peg won't mind a few screams, just to get a little mothering. In a moment, I thought, got to go phone. "Peg," I'll say, "marry me. Come tonight. Come home. We'll starve together, but by God, we'll live. Marry me at last, Peg, and protect me from the lonelies. Peg." And she would answer yes and come home. "Not hurt," I answered Crumley. "Good," said Crumley. "'Cause who in hell would read my novel if not you?" I barked with laughter. "Sorry." Crumley ducked his head with embarrassment at his own honesty. "Hell!" I grabbed his hand and put it on the back of my neck, showing him where to massage. "I love you, Crum. I love you, Henry." "Damn," said Crumley gently. "Bless you, boy," said the blind man. Another car arrived. The rain was stopping. Henry took a deep sniff. "I know that limo smell."
"Jesus God," said Constance Radigan, leaning out. "What a sight. World's champion Martian. World's greatest blind man. And Sherlock Holmes's bastard son."
We all responded one way or another to this, too tired to keep it up. Constance got out and stood behind me, looking down.
"Is it all over? Is that him?"
We all nodded, like an audience at a midnight theater, not able to take our eyes away from the canal waters and the lion cage and the ghost behind the bars that rose and fell and beckoned.
"God, you're drenched. You'll catch your death. Let's get the kid stripped and warm. All right if I take him to my place?"
Crumley nodded. I put my hand on his shoulder and held tight. "Champagne now, beer later," I said. "See you," said Crumley, "at my jungle compound."
"Henry," said Constance, "come along."
"Couldn't keep me away," said Henry.
And more cars arrived, and police were getting ready to dive in to get whatever that was out of the cage. And Crumley was walking over toward Schrank's hut, and I stood there trembling as Constance and Henry peeled off my wet jacket and helped me into the limousine. And we drove along the middle of the night coast among the big, sighing derricks, leaving behind a strange, small apartment where I worked and leaving behind the dark, small lean-to where Spengler and Genghis Khan and Hitler and Nietzsche and a few dozen old candy wrappers waited, and leaving behind the shut trolley station where tomorrow some lost old men would sit again, waiting for the last trains of the century. Along the way, I thought I saw myself passing on a bike, 12 years old, delivering papers in the dark morn. Further on, my older self, 19, wandered home, bumping into Poles, lipstick on his cheek, drunk with love. Just before we turned in at Constance's Arabian Fort, another limousine came roaring the other way along the shore highway. It passed like thunder. Is that me too, I wondered? Some year soon, and Peg in an evening gown with me, coming back from a dance. But the other limousine vanished. The future would have to wait. As we pulled into Constance's sandlot backyard, I knew a simple present and the best kind of a live happiness. With the limo parked and Constance and me waiting for him to move, with a grandiose wave, Henry raised his arm.
One side, or a leg off.
We stood aside.
Let the blind man show you the way.
He did. We gladly followed. End of Death is a Lonely Business by Ray Bradbury.